Susan Ashton's music, Waiting for Your Love to Come Down. Before that, Steve Bell with an old spiritual, nicely updated for you, Done Made My Vow. And we heard from Carolyn Aaron's Half a Million Reasons. Good morning to you. It is 14 minutes after the hour. We're Broken Road Radio. My name is Jim Park. David Allen Punt is here, too, and now joining us from Maryland, right on the edge of Washington, D.C., Doug Greenwald, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. Doug, good morning. Good morning.
Good morning, guys.
Morning.
Oh, David still is there. I thought you'd gotten snoozed off in the, the newsroom. Oh, okay.
I'm here.
Awaken alert.
You can't see my picture?
Oh, I can now. I can. You're doing fine.
My hair's a little messy.
Well, yeah.
Okay, I got it straightened out now. Okay, I'm fine. Okay.
Things looking good in the newsroom today. And, Doug, we're doing a little traveling today. We're going to head north out of Jerusalem and wend our way up. What do they call the route out of Jerusalem straight north? Is that the...
This is the Central Ridge Route.
Central Ridge Route, okay. And that heads north up into where Jesus had most of his ministry, which is Galilee and Capernaum and Caesarea and, of course, the sea or the Lake of Galilee, which bears a whole lot of resemblance, we've decided, to Mille Lacs Lake here in Minnesota. In fact, it's just a big, shallow dish, and I think Mille Lacs might be even a little bigger than the Sea of Galilee. So we can kind of relate to the environment there, but there's a town on the way, and I'm assuming Nazareth now. Wouldn't that be on the edge of the valley of the Jezreel Valley?
It is on a little northern indentation that goes up to Mount Tabor, right on sort of a northeast angle off the main part of the Jezreel Valley. That part is still considered the Jezreel Valley, but it's a little bit more northeastern facing. And what we're doing is continuing our theme of village life. Now, what was it like in a village? And so we've been talking about that for a number of weeks. And today I thought it might be of interest to go to a synagogue worship service.
Well, let's do that. I would love that. And now synagogues, and these would be like almost like community centers, wouldn't they? Because they had multiple uses throughout the smaller towns and villages and served as worship sites and schools, as we learned last week.
Very much. The Bet Midrash is attached to the synagogue. That's the synagogue, the local synagogue school. And of course, on Shabbat, you're going to worship in an adjoining, we would call it the sanctuary. But I like you, just to pause for a moment on your phrase, the community center. You know, we use that phrase here in the West, and for us, it means a place where a disparate community goes to be together. I was first struck by this in, I think, 1962. I was flying from Detroit, Michigan to Los Angeles. We were playing in a basketball tournament out there, a Christmas tournament. First time I'd ever gone across America. And we were on United Airlines, and we were flying over Iowa, and we were flying over Kansas. And you look down, and you see this grid work of county roads on mile square patterns.
Yeah,
it just looks like a huge checkerboard of mile squares. And in each square is a house. And then in the next square might be another house. And you get the idea how spread out America is. And so when you go to town, to what me a community center, this is the place where everyone comes to be together. But this notion of a community center has a different meaning in the first century, because they all live together by definition. The community is the community center in one sense, and the synagogue is sort of the hub of that kind of thing. If you've ever looked down from the air at a Middle Eastern village, they're all crammed together, or it's almost wall to wall, and the farmlands, you know, radiate out from the center of this cluster of towns, and that's of homes, and that's what we've been talking about. In those kinds of communities, there are no secrets because you live so close together, et cetera, et cetera. So the phrase community center has a little bit different meaning in the first century than we do it today.
Would folks in the first century have just kind of dropped by casually their synagogue, or would they have gotten all dressed up and gone for a specific purpose, or either?
Well, most people only own the clothes they're wearing.
Oh, okay.
I mean, we are talking about a very poor culture. 90% of the people are dirt poor. They're one crop infestation or one drought removed from debtor's prison. And so you don't have Sunday clothes and regular clothes. When you wash your clothes, it's probably because you've gone into a body of water with your clothes on. So we need to be a little bit careful in, again, projecting our ways of thinking onto the nature of that village world.
You know, we read in the New Testament about the heads of synagogues, the chief person that ran the synagogue. I presume they would have been responsible for maintenance and all the janitorial work and maybe conducting meetings there. Were they valued officials? Were they like pastors, or were they essentially non-religious? Who were these people, the heads of synagogues?
Well, the only one we know of is Jairus in Capernaum, who was the president of the synagogue there. And as far as we've been able to tell, while the Sadducees ran the temple in Jerusalem, the synagogues in the outlying areas were totally run by the Pharisees. And there was a president, and he was a Pharisee. And so one of the things we have to factor into our understanding as we make this village visit back to Nazareth here is that Pharisees are in charge of all the local synagogues. And so guess what? They're only going to invite their own fraternity in to read from the prophetic scrolls. And so the very fact that Jesus, as we're going to see here shortly, is invited back to read from the prophetic scrolls one Sabbath, tells us that he was seen as a Pharisee, because Pharisees only respected their own and only invited their own in to be a participant in the Shabbat worship service.
Well, you say participant. How about in the congregation? Can I call it that? Did just people come in off the street to hear what they had to say, or were they intellectuals? Were they educators? Were they the upper crust of local society? Who attended the synagogue?
I would say everybody in the village.
Ah, okay.
The men are on the main floor, and there's a U-shaped balcony on what we would call the second floor, and there's a big a drape that separates visually the ability of the women who are up there behind the curtain, so to speak, from having a sight line to the men down below. But they're there, but they're just participating in a different way.
So they could listen but not see, and not
yes.
Then not be seen.
Correct.
And there would have been a service, an agenda, an itinerary, a list of things to be done in a ritualized order, I would presume.
Yeah, our word for that would be liturgy.
Mm-hmm.
But let's pick that thought up in a moment here, because I actually want to go back to Nazareth as Luke describes it here. And I think it will be a really fascinating study. I'm not sure we'll get through all of this return of Jesus to Nazareth today, but we can finish it up next way if we need be. But I would like to start in Luke's fourth chapter in the 14th verse. And there Luke tells us that Jesus returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit. Now, he's just established his authority over his adversary in the 40 days in the wilderness. He returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit, and news about Jesus spread throughout all the surrounding district. The Galilee district is actually a political entity, a geographical entity in this culture. And so here's my first observation. You remember Columbo?
Yes, the TV show? Okay. Or you're talking about the church historian? The monk.
No, I'm back into contemporary culture here.
Oh, okay. Peter Falk, yeah.
Peter Falk.
Okay.
Can I ask you one more question?
Certainly.
In his detective mode. I think we need to be encouraged to be Columbos, to ask questions as we journey through a text. Remember that I think we can all remember reading the Curious George books to our grandkids,
oh,
right?
Little Monkey, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have to be curious in a certain sense as we go verse by verse through the scripture. And so the first curiosity that strikes me in verse 14 is, and news about him spread throughout all the surrounding district. Well, the question is, what news?
Mm-hmm. Miracles? Strength of teaching, charisma, reputation preceding him,
Yes, if we go through Luke's record, which is the only one I think is fair game to draw upon here, because Luke is constructing his narrative for a very specific purpose, Jesus has been exercising demons and healing the sick, not bringing back anyone from the dead, but healing the sick. And so if that's the case, if that's the news, what's the significance of that news?
Well, from the standpoint of the villagers in Nazareth, here was one of their own who turns out to be somebody entirely different than they expected.
But how would they have seen him if indeed he's exercising demons and healing the sick? What would their perception of him be?
Prophet.
But not Messiah.
Probably not at this point. This is really early in his ministry, isn't it?
Exactly. There's no indication here that those are clues that he's Messiah. In fact, when we get into the Mishnah, the codification of the oral tradition of the Jewish religion, we find out that exercising demons and laying on of hands for healing is fairly common amongst a certain subset of Pharisees that are known as the Hasidim, the miracle-working Pharisees of the north, of which Rabboni Hanan ben Dosa is one of them, cited in Mishnaic literature. Mm-hmm. So that observation says you got to be careful. You don't want to paint all Pharisees with the same paintbrush. The northern Pharisees are quite different from the southern Pharisees, and even in the northern Pharisees, there's a subset called the Hasidim, the miracle-working Pharisaic rabbis, who are viewed by the people as the Mother Teresas of that time.
So it's not like, you know, we're kind of trained to see Pharisees as the bad guys, self-righteous, false, fruitless, kind of egotistical, upper crust kind of things that look
certainly
down.
Is there, yeah. But you know, we always want to ask, where are we when certain things happen? Mm-hmm. And the Jerusalem Pharisees tend to get much more of Jesus' scorn than some of the other Pharisees throughout the country. But setting that aside, there is a certain subset called the Hasidim, miracle-working Pharisees, and I would suggest to you that's how the people of Nazareth would have viewed Jesus on this particular Sabbath day.
So they were highly respected.
They were loved. And they were really good people. They were salt of the earth. They had no arrogance and pride whatsoever. They served the poor. Truly, they were the Mother Teresas of their day in that religious culture. So when Jesus shows up in Nazareth, it's they're proud, I would suggest, is where they start here. And they say, look at our boy. Look at Joseph's boy. We thought he was just an average guy, but now he's a Hasidim, miracle-working Pharisee rabbi. My, aren't we proud of him? So I would say that's part of the backdrop, the backstory that goes with verse 14. And then we get to 15, and Jesus began teaching in their synagogues, and it's plural, not just one, and was praised by all.
Well, he would have been had to have been of some reputation in order to be invited to have that position in the service, correct? I mean, he would have come in with a reputation and would have been worthy of standing there and reading from the Torah.
I think after an exorcism or two, the word spread like wildfire.
Hmm.
Look what he's done. I think after he laid his hands on a person or two and healed them, the word spread like wildfire in those communities up there. And so I would suggest that's his perceived persona and reputation as he arrives back in his hometown. And obviously, it's more than just Nazareth, because the plural of synagogues means that perhaps in Chorazin, maybe already in Capernaum, we're not given the specifics, he's been invited in to be a participant in the Shabbat liturgy for worship. So anyway, and we get to verse 16, and Jesus came to Nazareth. And so that ought to cause us to pause here and say, what is Nazareth all about? I mean, who are these people? Any thoughts?
Well, it's in Galilee, so it tends to be a cultural mix. And I kind of sometimes confuse Galilee with Samaria, not the name so much, but wondering how much crossed over from Samaria, which is kind of an area of outcasts and untouchables, according to the Orthodox Jews. But the people in Galilee, probably rustics, bumpkins, agrarians, and poor. You mentioned poor, massively poor.
One of the things that's striking about the word Nazareth is there's no record of it in the Old Testament.
That's true.
So kind of suggests this is a New Testament town. Well, how did it come to be? When we go back in Jewish history, we're aware of in 586, Nebuchadnezzar conquers the south, Judea, and takes the creme de la creme of the youth and the merchant class, etc., back to Babylon. And then he dies, and then Cyrus comes in, and after a while, Cyrus allows Ezra to return with a remnant. Now, what we need to understand about that is when there's quite a period of time that's elapsed.
About 500 years.
Their departure and their return. And so there is quite a community, a large community of Jewish people in Babylon. And relatively speaking, very few of them return with Ezra.
Okay, you're talking about the 70 years of exile then, not the 500 years in between the rebuilding of the temple by Nehemiah and Jesus' time.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
And so over that period of time, most of the people did not return. They continued to procreate and grow back in Babylon. So by the time we get to the first century, there's really a very large population of Jews in Babylon. Well, then in 332 BC, Alexander the Great comes in, conquers this land, brings Greek philosophy, Greek language, imports Greek city-states, Macedonian city-states as part of his subjugation strategy. And he dies, and his generals fight over and squabble and what have you. And this all unfolds until about 167 BC, when there's a revolt led by Judas the Maccabee against the last of the Seleucid rulers, the Greek rulers in the land. And after about 15 years, the whole country is now back under Jewish control, and a man named John Hyrcanus is given the right to be, for the first time ever, high priest and king. That was a mistake, but that's what happened. But anyway, now back in Babylon, around 150 BC, word comes back, hey, guys, Jews are governing Jews again in Judea. Not since the time of David and Solomon have Jews been governing Jews. It's back like it was to the old days. Now is the time to return. Because many of them stayed in Babylon because they did not want to go back to their homeland while pagans still ruled that land. But now, for the first time since David and Solomon, the Hasmoneans are Jews governing Jews around 150 BC. There starts to be now a series of waves of exiles returning in, let's say, 130, 125, 120 BC. And when we dig into the Mishnaic literature, we found that there is a clan called the Natsura clan who comes south in one of these waves from Babylon to the Galilean area. And they settle in three areas. Some of them went to the Golan Heights, some of them went north and to the northern part of Galilee, and a third part of the Natsura clan went to a place and established Nazareth, and you get hence the origin of the name Nazareth from the Natsura clan. And so What's interesting about this is if people are going to return in an exile mode from Babylon, where do you think they would tend to go first? Where would they want to resettle?
Well, Jerusalem.
Absolutely. To be near the temple. But these returning waves settle primarily in the north. And so we have to understand who these people are. To use current vocabulary, they have a settlement mentality. Most of the Gentiles are living in the north. And from what we can remember of our geography study of the north versus the south, it's much easier and more delightful to live in the north. It's much more severe and Spartan and ascetic to live in the south. So if you're a Gentile and you've got a choice, you're going to choose to live in the north. So the predominant population of Gentiles are in the north, and these returning Jews have a settlement mentality, and they say, we are going to establish towns and villages throughout quickly so that we can start the process of claiming the Galilean district for Judaism and Jews, so that when Messiah comes, these Gentiles will be gone and our homeland will be Jews through and through. So, important backdrop to this story. The people in Nazareth, I would suggest from this line of thought and reasoning, are messianic zealots. They remember the Isaiah 9 prophecy that the light will first shine in Zebulun and Naphtali. Zebulun has a Z in it, and so does Nazareth. That's how I keep it straight. Mm-hmm. Nazareth is in the Zebulun tribal allotment, and Capernaum is in the Naphtali tribal allotment. So
this was an enclave then of rather extreme Orthodox Jews, and they were reclaiming Zebulun's territory in this case for the old religion, for the old folks, for the culture, the history, the tradition of what was once there.
And to pick up that phrase again, they're messianic zealots. I mean, they talk about Messiah morning, noon, and nights. I suspect in our culture today, the vast majority of people, or many people anyway, are talking about the debate last night. And the pundits will be talking about the debate for the next 6 days, I guess, until the next one comes along, almost 24/7 on the talking head shows. Well, that's the kind of preoccupation with the coming of Messiah that the people in Nazareth had. And so the tremendous irony here that Jesus, the Messiah, was born in a small, humble, out-of-the-way village filled with messianic zealots.
They came with a sense of that prophecy, didn't they? Because you've told us on previous occasions that at Jesus' birth, there was an expectation in Israel that the Messiah was soon to come, that it was a culmination of history at that point, and sure enough, he appeared in Bethlehem and was raised in Nazareth. So this influx of refugees, or now they were, I guess you'd call them immigrants from Babylon, really comprised the coming of the Messiah and a return to the prophetic world of the Old Testament.
Yeah, we don't have time to go into it, but there's this whole 70-year restoration backdrop theme that's also going on. And the closer they got to the 70-year anniversary of the invasion in 63 BC of Pompeii and the Roman 10th Legion, that was when Jesus was 12 years old. That would have been the height of messianic expectation, when Jesus was actually in the synagogue or in the temple in Jerusalem, more than holding his own with the best religious minds of his day. And so, yes, the people in the north would have had this expectation that shortly Messiah is because 70-year restoration cycle.
Okay, so we're in the synagogue in Nazareth, and Jesus has come with this, his reputation preceding him, and probably a pretty high level of expectation, excitement about what they're going to hear.
Can't you just, let's read the second half of verse 16. And he came to Nazareth, we just talked about that, where he had been brought up, and as was his custom, he entered the synagogue on the Shabbat and stood up to read. Now, that means he's been invited to read, and he's being invited to read, we find in verse 17, and the book of the prophet Isaiah, and more accurately, we should say, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Now, the way the liturgy works is there's about four or five phases. They'll read from the Torah, and that's a mandated reading of a certain portion of it. And then there'll be some prayers, and then they'll read something from the wisdom literature, and then there'll be some prayers, and this thing continues to build until it gets to the last stage, or the ultimate stage, if you will, if you're a worshiper. It's when the invited rabbi of the day reads from the prophetic scrolls. This is the highlight of the worship service. And the normal protocol here is that the chosen rabbi of the day read from one of the prophetic scrolls, and then he will comment on it. We'd call that a sermon, a commentary. Mm-hmm. And in this culture, the more creative you can be in your interpretation of what you've just read, the more points you get from your audience. That's why the body of religious literature and wisdom of the sages is always continuing to grow and expand, is because this culture values creativity. new, interesting, novel temptations, if you will. And then they'll all sort of caucus in a certain way, decide how much they really appreciated the new novelty, the new insights, the new interpretation that the rabbi brought for the day. So this is part of the expectation. So here comes Jesus, and as he goes to the front and begins to unfold the scroll that's handed to him, can you just imagine the people in the audience? Oh, there is Yeshua. Mm-hmm. Be proud of him. My goodness gracious, what can we do here to remember how, what a humble boy and what an obedient boy he used, but look at him now.
I remember when he was just that tall. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so this is all going on. Now, Jesus is going to read from Isaiah 61. How many chapters are, do you remember, are in the scroll of Isaiah?
66? No, that's the books. I don't know.
Put the scroll of Isaiah down.
It's a lot of stuff.
It's a lot of winding, isn't it?
Hmm.
So I'm guessing it might have taken 2 or 3 minutes for Jesus to unwind the scroll to get from what we know as chapter 1 down to chapter 61. Mm-hmm. So Russell, turn, Russell, turn. And the audience is saying, oh my, I wonder what he's going to be reading today. Aren't we proud of him? Well, remember back when, Okay, so all this is going on. Of course, Jesus knows this is going on. And there is some debate here whether there's a lectionary in force for the reading from the prophetic scrolls as there was for the Torah. I'm of the viewpoint that there wasn't, but some people maintain that there was. It doesn't matter. He's still going to read from the same portion of Scripture here. But eventually he gets to verse that what we know as chapter 66, found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free those who are oppressed, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord." Now, did you ever go back to Isaiah 61 and to see how close these five statements actually track to what's there?
Hmm.
Jesus is doing a cut and paste. He is not reading Isaiah 61, 1 and 2 as it is written. He's dropping two phrases out, one of which is making reference to the day of vengeance. The last thing these Jews need to hear is about vengeance against Gentiles. Okay? Mm-hmm. And he imports a phrase from Isaiah 58, 6. And so he is creatively, I would say, doing a cut and paste. Now, here's where some more subjective views enter in here. Some would say that this is what he is reading from Isaiah 61. I would suggest to you this is his commentary on Isaiah 61. Because typically in this protocol for worship, you're going to read a chapter or two, not just five sentences. And so I think Jesus has read the bigger passage, which we don't know what it was, maybe all of Isaiah 61, maybe Isaiah 60 and 61. And then he chooses to focus on the first two verses of Isaiah 61, 1 and 2 in a rearranged manner. Now, what's fascinating about this, and actually, we got 5 more minutes?
Let's do it. This is too good to drop here.
The people in the audience, the moment he utters the first part phrase of Isaiah 61:1, they know exactly where he is. Oh, that's Isaiah 61. That's one of our favorite passages. They know that one cold. And the reason they do is because, in part, this is their job description. This is what they live for. And so let me get over to Isaiah 61 here. Verses 4, 5, and 6, and early part of 7. This is from Isaiah 61. "Then they will rebuild the ancient ruins." They is these people who've moved back to Nazareth. Mm. They will raise up the former devastations. They will repair the ruined cities, the desolation of many generations. Strangers, read Gentiles, will stand and pasture your flocks, and foreigners will be your farmers and your vine dressers. You get the idea here? This is about inverting the whole thing going on. Instead of the Gentiles being over the Jews are now going to be over the Gentiles. Strangers will stand and pasture your flocks, but you will be called the priest of the Lord. Oh, I'm loving this, aren't you? Eliezer, you will be spoken of as ministers of our God. Now get this. You will eat the wealth of nations, and in their riches you will boast. This is why they're there. This is how they see their job description. This is their purpose. This is their raison d'etre, if you will. They are there to reclaim Galilee for Judaism and to make the Gentiles into their slaves. They love Isaiah 61. And they can't wait till Jesus gets to verses 4, 5, 6, 7.
Oh, you know, without context, David, how would you know that? This is so incredible.
Yeah, no, you wouldn't. And yeah, and the I'm struck by a couple of things. One of the things is your reference to politics earlier, and what we're talking about, and what has our focus now, and what's going to continue to get our focus in the near future. And you know, and this morning Jim and I were talking about the debates. I know that's hard to believe, but we actually were. And you know, Jim remarked, he said, 21 days till the election. And I said, yeah, and then we can start talking about the next election and what happens in the next 4 years. It's interesting that the focus is a future-oriented focus as opposed to just accepting things as they are.
Well, Doug, was Jesus playing to the crowd? Or is there, and maybe we can get to this next week, but there must have been a climax to this thing.
Well, the scene is about to shift radically. Everyone's feeling good right now. Everyone's loving this scene who's sitting in the audience, the friends, the family, acquaintances. And this whole thing is about to shift because Jesus has read from a messianic passage. And what I've often wondered is, what emphasis did he give to the word me when he did this cut and paste of these five statements? So let me give me an added emphasis here, and perhaps you can see how it started to go down in the audience. Because he anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives. You get the idea here?
Yes.
Jesus is reading from a messianic passage, and I would suggest to you, he's identifying with it as if he was Messiah.
So
the worm is going to start the turn here as the audience starts to turn against him. There's three stages of rage now that we're going to see as we go through the rest of this worship service. We're going to need another 30 minutes to do it, I suspect. But this is probably a good place to hit the pause button. Everything's going fine at this moment in time, and from the next verse on, the worm is going to start to turn.
Doug, this is fascinating. We're speaking with Doug Greenwald from Observing Bible Times. It's a ministry on the outskirts of Washington in Maryland there. And there's a website. You might want to visit them. They're a wonderful resource for your church and, as I say all the time, your small groups and your Bible studies. They even have our Digging Deeper programs available for you on CD. You can use those for your own personal studies or again, your small group discussions. PreservingBibleTimes.org. You can link to them from our website. BrokenRoadRadio.com. You're probably listening there right now, but a click on that button will take you there. And, Doug, this is exciting. I can hardly wait for next Wednesday.
Well, I get excited every time I get back into this passage. What Jesus has just done, by the way, is he's given his rescue manifesto. This is what he has come to do. And everything that Luke now documents is a fulfillment of what I would call these five statements here as Jesus' rescue manifesto. And we'll pick it up next week because we really didn't look at the literary construct of these five statements. In the rabbinic world, you're always teaching and talking in parallelisms. And this one is an inverted parallelism. And so we want to look at what's the core, what's statement three, as we get two surrounding statements on either side of the third statement here that are parallel in their construct. And there's a whole level of insight just in how Jesus put these five statements together. But we'll pick that up next week.
And we will indeed. We'll look forward to that. It's just apparent all over again how important culture is to the understanding of Scripture. It paints it in full color, full three dimension. It's just a great, great thing. Doug Greenwald, Preserving Bible Times, thank you so much. Be blessed, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks.
Music from Selah, Broken Road Radio, Wednesday morning. Good morning to you.
There's a fire.